What if I told you that you can support your blood pressure and healthy CoQ10 levels with two chews a day? The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. That's like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 supports your cardiovascular health. Visit RadioBeats.com and find out how you can get a free 30-day supply on bundles and save 15% with the promo code DEAL.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the Post's newsroom to life on stage.
Michael Duffy sits down with Dan Balls, Ruth Marcus, and Charles Lane to discuss the January 6th Select Committee hearing and the Cuban government crackdown after recent protests. Let's listen.
Good morning and welcome to First Look, WashingtonPostLive.com's first look in the morning at news and analysis of the day. I'm Michael Duffy, Opinions Editor-at-Large, and joining me this morning to start is Dan Balls, the Dean of the Political Press Corps and the Chief Political Correspondent of the Washington Post. Good morning, Dan. Always great to see you.
Good morning, Michael. Good to see you.
It appears now, after many years and much talk and a lot of coverage, we finally have some movement, official movement, toward action on infrastructure. It's, of course, just a beginning. But it has been a long time. The measure in front of the Senate now is just the first part of a multi-trillion dollar set of measures that the Biden White House would like to see move forward. But it has been a long time coming. Why the sudden shift, Dan?
Michael, I think a couple of things. One is, as you suggest, I mean, this has been a priority for a long time. This is not a new issue. It's an old issue, and it's an old issue that people have wanted to try to, you know, come together on, frankly, across parties to get it done. I think there are two big reasons. One is President Biden's commitment to try to do something in a bipartisan fashion. He talked about that from the beginning of his campaign, frankly, for president, and certainly in the early days of his presidency. And this was the measure that I think he thought was the best opportunity to demonstrate that there was still an opportunity for two sides to work together on it. But I also think that the group of 10 senators who were at the point on this, who had come together late last year to pass another COVID relief bill, and were determined to try to see what they could do on this one. I think everybody had a commitment that this needed to be done, both for the reasons of infrastructure needs, but also as a demonstration that Washington isn't completely broken.
And the group of senators seemed to get larger as we went through the spring and summer, enough from both parties to make me think there might even be some reason for optimism on bipartisanship. Is that silly of me?
No, it may not be silly of you. I think I still think that these are exceptions to the rule of a deeply divided Congress and a deeply divided country. And so on so many other things, the two parties go their own ways, and the gulf between them, both ideologically and now, you know, in a sense, the differences in their bases make it very, very difficult. I mean, if you think of the other major things that are at work here, there's very little prospect for bipartisanship on the second and gigantic piece of what President Biden hopes to pass, which is what he calls the human infrastructure bill, which is at this point not fully formed, but in the neighborhood of $3.5 trillion. Voting rights has completely separated the two parties. The January 6th insurrection has separated the two parties. Maybe criminal justice reform, a policing bill is still a possibility for bipartisanship. But I guess the other thing is that, you know, this is kind of an issue of muscle memory. Nobody remembers how to work in a bipartisan way, or very few people do. And so it may take, you know, success in this area to persuade people or to give people incentive to try to do it in some other areas. But what those particular issues and policies are, that's where I think the sticking point is.
No sooner had the bipartisan group completed its work and got an agreement to move forward than the former president, Donald Trump, had criticized the measure, clearly hopes it will not proceed. Is his criticism Will that make it harder to pass, particularly in the House, or is that not relevant?
Well, it's not irrelevant. It's simply because all Republicans know that he continues to have influence. But I think it's a question of where his influence will be most felt. The decision to open debate on the infrastructure bill, the Senate vote the other day, there were 17 Republicans who went along with all 50 Democrats. I mean, that's a lot of Republicans who said, we think this is a good idea and we ought to go forward. There will be forward motion and then setbacks until this either does or doesn't get done. I mean, I think that's the nature of something this big and complex and in which each party has its own concerns and suspicions about the other side. This bill's going to struggle in the House. There's no question about it. The liberal Democrats have questions about it. Conservatives will vote against it, but I think that at this point, there's more likelihood that this bill passes despite what the president says, the former president, than not. I mean, I think it's, again, everybody seems to have a sense of self-interest that you need to get the infrastructure bill in order to also get the big reconciliation package that will start in the Senate and then head to the House.
One more question about the former president. This week, there was a Republican primary in Texas for a House seat. The Trump-backed candidate lost. Does that tell us anything about the former president's influence either inside the party or in general, in your view?
Michael, I think it tells us a little bit, but not necessarily a lot. I mean, the special elections are special elections, and they're, they're given to all sorts of vagaries. Dave Weigel of our staff, who covered this race far more closely than I did, has made the point that the Trump-backed candidate, Susan Rice, was not a particularly energetic or active candidate, nor did former President Trump do much more than send out a few, statements saying she's the candidate I want. And so candidates and campaigns still matter despite endorsements. We know that endorsements are sometimes valuable, but not always. And so I wouldn't read too much into this. I think that in primaries going forward, Republican candidates on the whole will want Donald Trump's support rather than not his support. But it doesn't mean that getting Donald Trump's support necessarily guarantees that you're going to win a primary.
And a quick question before we finish about the news on the pandemic front. The other big news, of course, this week was that there have been shifting guidelines from the government as well as the federal government as well as local government about the use of masks. Does this create a danger for the Biden White House as it tries to move the country out of a mode of shutdown and shut-in toward gradual reopening? What do you think the impact of that will be politically?
Well, I mean, we're in a period of flux and therefore confusion. And it's always difficult for an administration that has, whose message from the very beginning is we're going to get through this and we're going to get the vaccinations in people's arms and we're going to reach that point where we're going to have the equivalent of herd immunity and we will be able to open up. And this Delta variant has proven to be far more dangerous than people thought at the beginning, far more transmissible. And it's causing obviously a reassessment of what are the best and protocols to use. Clearly masks are coming back in indoor situations in various places. Various companies are saying that their employees will have to be vaccinated to be back in the office. But for the Biden administration, this is going to be a big challenge because one, they're going to have to temper their message. Two, they're going to have to, not just double down, but triple down or quadruple down on pushing vaccinations and finding ways to, to persuade people who have been resistant, reluctant, or unwilling to get a vaccine to be vaccinated. So, it couldn't come at a worse time, obviously, because everything has been pointing to a reopening in the fall, particularly schools. And the degree to which that doesn't happen or that the ground rules are going to be different is going to be confusing to people, and that's going to cause problems and backlash.
Dan, always thoughtful, always great to see you. Thanks for taking time with us this morning, and be careful out there.
All right, thanks. You too, Michael.
And now, on to the opinion side, and our two guests this morning, Deputy Editorial Page Editor Ruth Marcus. Morning, Ruth.
Good morning, Michael.
And political columnist Chuck Lane. Good morning, Chuck. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Mike.
Okay, Ruth. Washington has been talking about infrastructure for years, longer if we want to admit our age. But this week it really did take a first step. What do you think are the big hurdles that it faces?
I think that the big hurdles that it faces are not from Republicans at this point. Republicans have made a decision that their desire to deny President Biden and Democrats a victory is outweighed by the fact that they dangled this infrastructure package, which had bipartisan support, in front of the American people, and they were going to get blamed more for yanking it back than they were going to benefit from denying Biden a victory. So the problems are twofold and they're intertwined. They are for President Biden and the Democratic leadership to navigate between the two wings of their own party to make sure that Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin stay on board, not on board this package, but that that Democrats are capable of crafting this larger $3.5 trillion reconciliation package in a way that will keep those two critical votes on board. And the reason that that's important is that, as you suggested in your previous conversation with Dan, liberal Democrats can start to balk if they think that bigger rug is going to be pulled out from under them. And then finally, there is the known unknown, which is that the Democrats' majority in the Senate could, if something terrible happens to an individual senator, disappear at any time. So things look much, much better for this package now than they did a week ago. And I think they look very good for the package, but that's not to say it's smooth sailing.
Chuck, do you agree? Do you think the biggest single threat to the measure comes from right or left?
Well, Peter Fazio, who is the progressive chairman of transportation in the House side, is furious because he's been bypassed on this deal. And apparently behind closed doors, he resorted to some pretty strong language to express that the other day. And that's indicative of a certain mood on the left in the Democratic Party in the House, who feel that, you know, the party is letting itself be jammed by this group of Republicans and Democrats who are willing to play with Republicans in the Senate. I think that can all be worked out, but if the question is where is the friction going to come from, I think it's going to come from that direction. And then, you have this kind of wild card that was thrown into it yesterday, or maybe it was the day before, when Kyrsten Sinema said she's not for a $3.5 trillion companion bill on the human infrastructure side, so to speak. If she's a no on that, you've got to go back to the drawing board on that bill. And, you know, there are a lot of Democrats who just won't let the infrastructure go until they know what the companion is going to be. But it's actually very hard to gauge where that whole business stands. I tend to come down the same place where Ruth does, is at the end of this, the self-interest of most of the people in Congress will be at least get the infrastructure done. But there's going to be a lot of very interesting political drama between now and then.
There's been also quite dramatic news overnight about not only the virulence of the Delta variant, but also a considerable amount of movement, guys, on guidance from the government about how we are to comport ourselves in this environment over the next couple of weeks and months. I thought I'd try to get your thoughts on that. Chuck, you wrote last week in a column that it was time to start paying people to take the vaccine. So I guess I thought I'd ask, is $100 enough, which is what the president, $100 enough, that's what the president suggested the state and local governments use to pay people to take the vaccine. Is that enough? And is it fair to ask some people to take it for free and let others get paid to do it?
I just want to say this is the first time anyone's ever listened to one of my columns. So okay. I'm very excited
it may not happen again, but it's happening now.
But I just want to say, if it all goes wrong, it's not my fault. You know, it's interesting. Right now, as we speak, in Colorado, they have been actually for about a week offering $100 Walmart gift cards to people to get vaccinated. And I've asked the state for any data they might have on how that's working out, but it's a little too early. I have seen anecdotally that the lines for vaccination increased, and local media found people saying they were encouraged to do it because they and everybody in their family who did it got $100 for back to school and so on. I think this is something that's obviously I wrote it. I think it's a smart idea. I think it's in part a smart idea because people respond to incentives generally. But also, I think, look, we're in a new game. We didn't know we were headed for this wicked Delta variant. And you know, in a way, desperate times call for desperate measures. I fully understand the people who are upset that, look, I did it and nobody paid me, except that I think what they're overlooking is that if you got it for free too, number one, it was a thing of value. And number two, a lot of people have been paid already to do this. A lot of companies am I freezing up? Companies have already paid people to get the vaccine. And the government has been underwriting some of these corporate programs for free time off to get the vaccine and so on. So I think what President Biden is doing, he acknowledged the concerns that people have. I think it's very pragmatic, and it's the kind of thing you do when you're in an emergency.
Ruth, do you agree? Is this
Chuck freezing up was going to just give me free rein to talk for the rest of our time, but that's okay. I'm all for carrots. I do not care at all if some people are unhappy that they didn't get their $100. This is not about fairness. It's about public health and the safety of us and all of our families. The problem with Chuck's very good column was that it didn't go far enough, because carrots aren't adequate here. We need to have sticks. And I think that I was very pleased to see President Biden wielding some degree of stick when talking about either mandates or intensive repeated testing for federal workers. I think he should go further. I think he could extend it now to the military. I'd extend it to all federal contractors. I wouldn't give people a choice. We don't have a choice at the Washington Post, except with exceptions. Private employers, state governments, the federal government, colleges and universities, certainly healthcare institutions, everybody we can think of at this point should require vaccines, with reasonable exceptions for religion and health, because not getting the vaccine doesn't just affect you, it affects everybody around you with what Chuck appropriately called this wicked variant.
Let's turn to that dramatic hearing that we had earlier in the week with the four police officers, two from the DC police, two from the US Capitol Police, in front of a new special panel in the House that's looking into the events that caused the January 6th riot at the Capitol. Ruth, what's the goal of a panel like this, and how do hearings like that fit in?
Well, I think that the goal is twofold. I was riveted by the hearings, and I was reminded of all the powerful hearings that I've watched and sat through before, where you kind of know the testimony that's coming, or you can understand intellectually the import of the testimony that's coming. But to hear the individual accounts from people who lived through that moment and what it was like for them was, I'm a little bit reminded of Christine Blasey Ford's testimony or Anita Hill's testimony before that, or some of the testimony at the previous impeachment hearings of President Trump. Hearing that personal account is just a searing reminder for people about what threat was posed to our democracy. I think the bigger goal of these hearings and the really important one is going forward, which is now we've set the stage, something terrible. Everybody should acknowledge, every American should acknowledge that something terrible happened on January 6th. Then the question is, how did that happen? Who was responsible for it? What happened inside the White House? What happened inside the Pentagon? Why did things go so dramatically wrong? For history and to understand what happened, and also a little bit for prevention in the future.
Chuck, it took weeks to set this panel up. It was the subject of, even by recent standards, intense political jockeying. People were named to the panel, then turned away from the panel. The Republican goal clearly going into the first hearing was to undercut the legitimacy of the group. Do you think it worked?
Do I think that their effort to undercut the legitimacy of the group worked? I'm going to say no to that, because I think people have pretty much made up their minds on one side or the other. I think there's a hardcore of pro-Trump Republicans who simply are in denial about this, and I think that's an extraordinary development. But I certainly don't think they've succeeded in discrediting this panel with the broader public. I do think that it would have been best if we could somehow have had a more bipartisan process and panel. But when Kevin McCarthy chose quite provocatively to put Jim Jordan and some other highly partisan people on the panel, for Nancy Pelosi, I agree with Ruth. I think that this was very important what was going on cameras this week, but the real importance of this panel for history is going to be what they do much more quietly when they're gathering facts behind closed doors, taking depositions, piecing together all the details that are going to need to be established about exactly what happened second by second as this developed, because that's where we're going to learn about the structural problems in the government that may have allowed this to happen. And I hope that the group is well staffed and committed to doing that very difficult work.
Ruth, on that score, I think there was a decision this week by the Justice Department. I think it said that it would not support the claims of former Trump officials who might try to escape testimony or testifying in front of this panel with a claim of executive privilege, which hasn't always been the case between White Houses and congressional panels. What's the significance of that decision given, as you mentioned, the stakes going forward?
I think it's very significant. I think incumbent presidents have the authority to assert executive privilege on behalf of their predecessors. And they're often inclined to do that because they don't want their own executive privilege, their own private, confidential, freewheeling communications with their advisors to be subject to a congressional inquiry. What the Justice Department said in this letter to the committee or to the potential witnesses was, we are not going to assert executive privilege on behalf of President Trump, and so you are not bound by that. I think that makes it much easier to essentially to obtain or maybe even force testimony from some of the people in the Justice Department. One of the people that this letter went to was the former acting attorney general, Jeffrey Rosen, to get the testimony that we really need from insiders to understand what's going on. There've been so many times in the previous administration that critical testimony was denied to congressional hearings. This is a really good move on the part of the Justice Department and very well justified.
Chuck, one of the other things that happened this week on this front about the insurrection was we saw House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy and Republican Congress folks like Elise Stefanik of New York suggest and charge, claim that the events of 1-6 really were the result of actions by Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. What do you make of that?
Well, I haven't followed that particular accusation for a while. When I first encountered it, it took the form of Pelosi allegedly failing to beef up the police presence or preparation, notwithstanding warnings she had received. I mean, it's typical politics. It's when your party is on the spot and when there's a lot of evidence that you guys are guilty of something bad, you just make a counter accusation against the other guys to try to, you know, see what you can get out of it and confuse the issue. I would note that there is a very interesting development in South Carolina along those lines. Tom Rice, who's one of the moderate Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump in a pretty safe Republican district down in South Carolina, has just gotten a primary challenger. And the primary challenger's campaign is basically, it was bad that he voted to impeach Trump after January 6th. That's the mood in the Republican base. And Kevin McCarthy and Elise Stefanik are behaving accordingly.
Last question for both of you. And it's about, again, the importance of the insurrection in the year. When it first happened, I think we'd all agree that this seemed and felt like a major event that would have long legs and lasting implications for our politics. 6 or 7 months on, I'm less clear about that. What's your sense, and I know this is a tough one, but can we do it quickly since we're nearly out of time, about whether this will continue to have an impact?
If I can go first, I think it does. And I think it does in two ways. First of all, on January 6th, 7th, and 8th, we had people like Kevin McCarthy, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell talking about the horror of January 6th and how it cannot be allowed to happen again. That has dissipated, and that's not politics as usual, just to disagree for a bit with Chuck. That is the ultimate gaslighting, to throw this on Nancy Pelosi. If there was ever a time for Congress to be able to come together, it should have been in defense of the safety and sanctity of its own institution. So the fact that we've devolved into this state is very, very worrisome for things going forward. And the second is that we're having essentially a slow motion insurrection in the form of laws that could permit a January 6th outcome to come up differently with a certification of votes in 2025. Sorry, I went on.
That's okay. Chuck, we're out of time. You're going to have to save it for your next column, which we'll talk about on the next show. But thank
I'm apologizing to Chuck. Sorry, Chuck.
Thank you. Thank you, Chuck. Thanks for watching. To find out all the other programs that are available on WashingtonPost.com, WashingtonPostLive.com, please check out our website and have a great day. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To hear more interviews from this series and other Washington Post Live programs, visit us at WashingtonPostLive.com.